Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
The whole process of pumping and then bottle feeding was so overwhelmingly time consuming that I just pretty much early on, I was like, I need to just make this into my art somehow, you know? It was sort of like all of this time is taking away time I would have in my studio. So I'm just going to boil it all, you know, together and make it into an art project.
I'm delighted to share that this episode of the Artist Mother Podcast is sponsored by an artist, mother, and tax expert, Hannah Cole of Sunlight Tax. Is your creative practice gaining steam? Maybe you just got a big grant or a big show. You're excited to get to work, but a nagging feeling tells you that there are some tax issues that could hurt you. What you don't know might actually be holding you back from all that you can accomplish. You just want to get down to the studio and do the work you love, but finances and tax concerns are dragging you down. Thankfully, Sunlight Tax is here for you. Artist and tax pro Hannah Cole started Sunlight Tax to empower creative people with the tax and money tools you need so you can have more money, more time, and make a bigger impact with your work. Who doesn't want that? Sunlight Tax offers an annual membership called Money Bootcamp, which is tailored to your busy creative life to teach you targeted skills for your financial health and taxes. Hannah guides you through the pitfalls into simple systems so you can stay on track, start investing in yourself, and get back to the studio without getting bogged down. Right now, listeners of the Artist Mother Podcast can get a free artist tax deduction guide by going to sunlighttax.com/artistmother. That's sunlighttax.com/artistmother. Thank you, Hannah, for providing so much to artists and helping us through with all of our financial concerns. It's so reassuring to have experts like you we can trust and we know are looking out for us. Head to sunlighttax.com to find out more about everything Hannah has to offer, and don't forget your free artist tax deduction guide just for our community at sunlighttax.com/artistmother. I am delighted to share in conversation with two incredible artist mothers for this episode all about art making, breastfeeding, and making art about breastfeeding. Thanks so much, Tracy Taylor and Catherine Duclos, for joining me. Tracy Marie Taylor is a Chicago-based multimedia artist and educator. She holds an MFA in painting and drawing from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and is an associate professor and chair of the Department of Art and Art History at Lake Forest College. Taylor's studio practice thematically and practically explores the relationship between nature and technology. Through her art, she surveys the assisted reproductive and breastfeeding technologies that were her companions during struggles to become a mother and in her efforts to sustain new life. She embraces traditional tools such as painting and sculpture, as well as digital tools such as video and creative coding. Tracy lives outside Chicago with her husband and son. And we're also going to be joined by Catherine Duclos, Catherine received her MFA in painting and drawing from the Pratt Institute in 2012 in Brooklyn, New York. After 10 years in New York, she moved to Vancouver in late 2017 with her family, where she maintains a studio practice exploring painting, sculpture, photography, and installation. Her current work deals with themes of motherhood and its often invisible emotional toll. She has exhibited her work in Canada and the United States, and she has worked as a teaching artist for organizations such as Studio in a School in New York City and the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Catherine currently lives in Vancouver with her husband and two young children. Catherine and Tracy, thank you so much, both of you, for being here. Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Yes,
I'm thrilled. I know, you're two people that I'm so grateful to know because of this community. So it's just kind of special to, like, you know, circle back around and get to talk to you. So thank you so much. So always like to have you start by sharing something about your childhood that you feel like connects you to your life as an artist. Curious to hear if either of you, if both of you have known that you've always wanted to be an artist, or if you kind of stumbled your way to art later in life. Tracy, can you start?
Sure. I think I've known that I wanted to be an artist for as long as I can remember. I think that
I'm always jealous of people like that.
Yeah.
I feel like I've said that before, but I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, I feel really lucky in that way. I think in large part, passion for art was inspired by one of my grandmother's oldest childhood friends, who went on to become a pretty famous Walt Disney animator named Exotencio. He did a lot of like the original, really early Disney films, and then went on to become an Imagineer and designed the Haunted Mansion and the Pirates of the Caribbean ride.
Ooh, that's so cool.
Yeah. So I just grew up hearing all of these amazing stories about how he would come and visit and just, you know, be like, here's Mickey Mouse. Oh, here's a little sketch of Donald Duck. And I was like, that's what I'm going to be. I'm going to be a Walt Disney animator. I know this. I don't need to look any further. And then I went to undergrad and had a really interesting art history class where I learned all about the lurid history of Disney. And my interest was swayed more into contemporary art.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I like the sort of, not that I'm a huge fan of Disney either, but I like the sort of interest in animation and technology and, you know, just sort of that entry point. I mean, I do think Disney is wonderful for that, like, imagination, creativity, like seeing art really, you know, as a kid. Like, I mean, there's no doubt that Disney films are art, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't really grow up having a strong background in art. I never went to art museums or anything like that with my family. So for me, you know, animation was kind of my entry point into art.
That makes sense. Catherine, what about you? Did you know that you always wanted to be an artist?
I often say in hindsight now that I did not know, but I recently rediscovered a book that I wrote in 5th or 7th grade. I don't know, in middle school sometime. And it was called Just Serve the Ball. And it was about a girl in a volleyball team. I don't know. And I wrote it and I illustrated it. And then I wrote like on the back cover, there's like about the author. And I wrote about myself. And the last line is like that I want to be either an artist or a dancer.
Ooh.
I had no real recollection of that. I did draw as a kid and I took some after school art classes. So it was definitely part of my life. Mm-hmm. But then in high school, I kind of moved on to writing more, and I ended up studying writing as an undergrad, and Mandarin was my minor. And so I moved away from visual arts, and I still had a photography hobby, I guess. And then I moved abroad after undergrad, and I really continued pursuing photography. And then that led me to graduate school. And I got my MFA kind of without expecting it. It was such a weird turn of events for me. So now I never really saw myself where I am now.
You didn't study photo in your MFA though, right? Was it just a visual arts MFA?
It was painting and drawing. But I actually started at Pratt in the art education master's program.
That's right. Okay.
And because I had no prerequisite credits, I had to do foundation year. And so that was really my first introduction to serious kind of art study. And then I switched into the MFA program a little while later.
I just asked that because I kind of entered my MFA where my only visual art background was photography, but knowing I want to leave photography behind and I want to become a painter, but I didn't like, you know, my MFA is kind of what I use to like bridge that gap. But I know like a program like Pratt probably would have made me take a foundation year, you know, like different programs have different expectations and whatever. We don't have to get into that whole bashing MFA programs, but you know the drama.
Yes, I do.
Okay, Catherine, can you keep going and describe your art maybe for someone who's never had the pleasure of viewing with it? You can talk about some of the different mediums that you use. We're going to mostly talk about your conceptual art around motherhood, but feel free to tell us about the wide range of work that you make.
Okay. I consider myself now a multimedia artist. And so for a long time, I was doing acrylic and ink abstract work, just two-dimensional painting. But I did keep doing photography on this side, and that informed my practice a lot. I would not say I have a distinct style. Like, it would be really hard for me to describe what my work looked like mm-hmm. to somebody, both when I was just painting and now. My most recent work for the last year was a huge pivot for me. Mm-hmm. I went from just doing 2D ink and acrylic abstract paintings to doing installations and sound pieces and sculpture. I'm working with text, video, like it's just a complete departure. I think the one thing that connects all of my work is collecting materials mm-hmm. and then using those materials as the basis for the work. I think when my work is most successful to me, when somebody can look at it with sort of a curiosity and say, what is that? Mm-hmm. Like that's success for me. So
I like that. Tracy, what about you? Can you describe your work for somebody who maybe has never seen it before?
Well, I feel like I am very similar in my practice as Catherine, and in that my work is very hard to pinpoint. I'm really all over the place. Also a multimedia artist. Even though both my undergrad and MFA were in painting and drawing, kind of similar to you, Kaylin, when I got into the MFA program at the Art Institute, I just felt like, okay, I'm in painting, but I felt like I already kind of know how to do painting. I'm by no means an expert, but I felt very hindered by the fact that I didn't know how to make videos or do installations. And so when I was in grad school, that's really kind of what I was focusing on, is trying to get a little bit of media experience under my belt. And then, you know, that just sort of snowballed. I ended up getting teaching jobs, teaching, you know, Photoshop and Illustrator, because at the time nobody, you know, very few painters had digital skills. Mm-hmm. And then the teaching informed my practice. So my practice has evolved mostly away from painting, although I do circle back to it fairly frequently. But I did a lot of work for about, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years that was all conceptually focused on the history of the American West from a feminist perspective, and also from a post-Turnerian perspective. So just basically looking at the myth of the American frontier and how all of, you know, the identity of Western individuals was supposed to be, you know, fused and sort of eliminate racial and gender tensions, but of course that's absolutely not true. So I spent a long time focusing on moments in our history where that was especially poignant. And then the last 4 years, my work has taken it also a huge pivot to focusing really exclusively on the experience of motherhood and the invisible labor of motherhood. And I've been doing that through painting and video and quite a bit of work that involves data visualization and creative coding.
So interesting. I love that both of your practices are so diverse, and that you, I don't know, it seems like you really just kind of don't hold back with materiality. You just like go wherever the concept needs to go. And that's, I definitely am one of those artists that thinks the other way around. Like I'm like, this is the materiality I know, and so I'm going to try to kind of like squeeze this concept into the materials. And I like talking with you because I want to get inside your brain and like think like, how can I think about that in a different way, and you know, not let the unfamiliar, I guess, like hold me back. Maybe we can talk about that in a little bit when we talk a little bit more about your work. You know, just because I'm sure that comes with a lot of failure too, though, right? Like,
yeah.
If you definitely have no idea, you know, you're like, I don't know how to make video. Like, I'm just going to figure this out. And like, it must be hard to like have to learn the hard way all of these things, you know?
It is, but it's also, I think that's what sustains my interest in art making, is just constantly getting to be a student. And, you know, I feel like once I've grasped a certain, you know, technology or medium, even the tiniest bit, then I'm like, I'm bored. I want to move on to something else.
That's so
I'm
funny.
The same way.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah. I it's so funny because I feel like I've heard, you know, that like there's art myths out there that can like support either side of that, you know, like, oh, well, you just don't have a long enough attention span. Oh, well, you're not taking risks. Like, you know, there's all of these, the inner critic can come at us from any which way. Like there's no one way to be an artist, as we know, but also for every way that you try to be an artist, there's an inner critic that's going to be there to beat you down.
I feel like it's that inner critic thing that really shaped my desire to constantly be looking at new processes and materials, because when I was an undergrad, one of my professors would make a really big deal about embracing being uncomfortable. And that as soon as you felt a certain level of comfort in your studio practice, you should be wary of that, because that means that you're not learning. And I think maybe I took that a little too seriously.
Is that how you feel too, Catherine?
A little bit. For me, it's more a question of problem solving. Mm-hmm. I think that creativity in my life is really strongly related to kind of figuring something out, responding to a problem or a question and trying to find the answer. And so if there's a material that I'm working with and I haven't quite found the answer to the question I'm asking, then I'll stay with it for a long time. Like I painted on Yupo for years and years and years, and I still do, because it was a really unique surface and I was interested in figuring out all the different ways that I could paint on it. And that sustained my interest for a long time. And then I realized shortly after moving to Vancouver that I was relying on the material too much, that it was the surface qualities that were bringing out a lot of what I liked in my work. And so I wanted to put more, I don't know, kind of start over and find a new thing to respond to. And it took me a couple years to figure out what that new thing was going to be. And now that I'm working with a theme as opposed to one specific material, my work has changed quite a bit, because the theme allows for so many different investigations of the same idea. And so, you know, it's like I had a material and it said, okay, what material do, or I sorry, I had objects that I was collecting and I was like, what material should I use to transform these objects? And like the answers were completely different than they would have been for me 2 years ago. So yeah, it brought out completely different questions, answers, methods, processes. And I've since sort of realized that's the artist that I want to be. I don't want to go back to just painting. I want to be able to pose multiple questions at once and come at them from different directions.
That's really lovely. I love the way you kind of talk about, you know, your work not as a singular voice, but maybe as a container or a chorus of voices, like that are all kind of singing the same song, maybe.
Yeah, I think there's a harmony that gets created between lots of different threads of my work. And that's always been present. I've always had like different series and kind of different ideas being teased out in different ways. But this new work is probably the most broad in terms of the net I'm throwing out there with my themes and materials, for sure.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more sort of about who you are outside of art. We're going to spend the rest of the interview talking about art and motherhood, but you know, just curious, do either of you have another job? You can talk a little bit about your kids or like what your personal life is like, where you live, that kind of thing. Tracy, can you start?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, I have a full-time job outside of artist and mother. I am an associate professor and chair of the art and art history department at Lake Forest College. So I'm really grateful, especially in today's economy, to have a job. But it is a pretty all-consuming career. So that really sort of relegates my studio times mostly to when I am not in the, you know, in the middle of a semester.
Yeah, like summer.
Yeah, summer, winter. Yeah. You know, if I can get the energy, the weekends.
Yeah, that makes sense. What about you, Catherine?
I am pretty much full-time mom, full-time artist. I was teaching prior to my son being born, and I was teaching pre-K through eighth grade art. Mostly with an organization called Studio in a School, which is a nonprofit that places artists into Title I schools that don't have existing art programs. So I bounced around schools all over New York City teaching. And I thought I would continue that when my son was born, at least part-time, and then into full-time later on. But it just didn't play out that way. And so he'll be five in March, and I haven't gone back to teaching. And then I have my daughter in 2019, and I will probably stay home with her until she goes to school as well. We're fortunate that we can survive on my husband's income and the small bit I make as an artist. But I couldn't, when you ask the question of what I am outside of artist and mother, I don't really feel like I exist outside of those two realms right now. Just don't have time to exist.
Yeah, I mean, and what a gift. Like, you know, again, it's like one of those things where we could look at it one way and say like, oh, I should be something else. But also, like, you don't have to be anything else. And that's so great.
Catherine, I am grateful for my job, but I am so jealous of being a full-time mother and full-time artist. That just sounds so dreamy.
Well, I guess I can't really say full-time artist. I get like 6 hours of studio time a week.
Yeah. Full-time mother, part-time artist, you know, but it ebbs and flows. We get a vacation day here and there, and then, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're mostly going to talk about the conceptual work that both of you make around breastfeeding and motherhood. But I wanted to start this conversation at the giving birth stage, or like the pregnancy stage, because I know, Tracy, your work has been influenced by your journey with pregnancy. And, you know, just wanted to like open up that door as the entry point for this conversation and have both of you talk a little bit about, I mean, really the seed of like where motherhood began for you and where it started to influence your work. I'm kind of interested, like, was it pregnancy? What was it, you know, giving birth? I know that, you know, we'll talk about your work with breastfeeding, but kind of wanted to hear a little bit about how this started, how motherhood started to like seep into your art practice.
Yeah, I think in a way, maybe the idea of being a mother seeped into my artwork in the absence of art, because my husband and I tried unsuccessfully for 4.5 years to get pregnant. And, you know, that involved every manner of fertility treatment known to man, except for surrogacy. And that process just left me so incredibly depressed and depleted that I pretty much stopped making art during that time and wasn't sure that I would ever return to it. So giving birth, it was really unexpected that it was like almost like I gave birth to my son and rebirthed my passion for art making. It happened simultaneously and was completely not expected. So I don't think, you know, like giving birth was really easy for me. And it was a really beautiful experience, maybe because I was just, you know, I mean, it wasn't easy. I had all, you know, I had complications and problems, but I was just so grateful to be pregnant and to be giving birth.
It was emotionally easy, maybe.
Yeah, like, I don't care how it happens. Yeah. Just want a baby, you know? So that was pretty great, you know? So I don't think, I tend to like making art about really depressing, dark subjects. So the fact that I had a, you know, relatively joyous birth means that that didn't really factor into my studio.
Yeah. But do you have work about your like struggle with infertility?
Yeah, I do. Right now it's mostly in sketches and things that I keep a little bit more private. The work that I did right after my son was born, that work is the most like directly related to my struggles with infertility. I started painting him when I had like a really old, like 1970s, or it wasn't that old. It was like maybe early 2000s, baby monitor that was black and white and kind of low res.
Yeah. I've seen this work.
Yeah. I was just in love with the way that he looked in that monitor.
Yeah. And you so just basically painted the monitor scenes, right?
Yeah. I would take photographs when I thought that he looked interesting in the monitor. Yeah. And then I would paint from the photographs. But I realized that I was like intentionally leaving out all of the like indications of a crib, leaving out any sense of perspective. So it looked like he was falling. Or, you know, often because he was sleeping, it looks like he was dead. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was like, strangely, like attracted to that and maybe doing it on purpose. And that's when there's one painting where it looked like he was drowning. And I was like, a little alarmed, why am I painting my son to look like he's drowning? And then it occurred to me, these are not about my son at all. Mm-hmm. These are about, you know, all of the struggles that came before him. Mm. Yeah.
These are the blue, they're mostly like blue paintings, right?
Yeah, blue and black paintings. And those were done, you know, when Hudson was just a few months old in the middle of nap times. Mm. Yeah.
We'll definitely make sure we get some of that work on the feed and be posting it so people can hear about it. Okay, Catherine, what about you? Do you feel like your experience giving birth, you know, influenced sort of your perception of yourself as an artist, or did it, like, how did that connect for you?
I think, so I had two very different birth experiences. My son, who was born in 2016, was born in New York City. And that pregnancy, everything was fine. I did not have any actual complications, but I was treated as if I would my entire pregnancy. And so there was a lot of over-checking. I had appointments all the time. And part of this was because of a previous heart condition, which has completely resolved itself. But because it's on like my medical file, as I had this once, therefore, I require all these extra maternal medicine specialists. And I felt very nervous and scared that whole pregnancy, because I felt this sort of narrative of something going wrong was being pushed on me. Mm. And I had a lot of trouble letting go during birth. I had a lot of trouble kind of accepting and letting go. And I was induced on my due date with my son, again, because of fears. And I wasn't ready. He wasn't ready. It was incredibly difficult labor. And
why do they do that?
My
due date too.
It makes me so mad. I had to fight tooth and nail for every kind of bit of birth freedom that I got in that pregnancy and that experience. And then in Canada, it's so different. Midwife care is the norm. You actually have to have a referral to even see an OB. Like most women, just unless you're in a high risk category, that's not going to happen. And so I had a midwife, and I did get an OB referral, just again, because of the same like past complications. And so I did have double appointments at times, but the whole thing was so much more hands off. I could have done a home birth if I wanted to. It was so much more mother-centered. Mm-hmm. And so I felt really held. I felt really supported by my midwives and just that it was going to be okay. And I think I was far more relaxed because of that.
You'd been through it before too, right? Like, you know, I feel the same way. I had the same experience where I had like a great midwife the second and third time. And I actually gave birth to my second and third kids at home. And mm-hmm. it was like great, super empowering, went really well. But I also feel like, I don't know if I could have done a home birth like on my first one, you know?
Yeah.
Even whether or not it was like the doctors inducing the fear in me or whatever, but just the like unknown of...
Yeah, you don't know.
I don't know what childbirth is going to be like. I don't know how I'm going to be, which maybe doesn't equal I should be at a hospital, but,
right.
you know, it's like, I don't know. I do feel like there's just, you feel more confident in yourself the second time around, you know?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think also being induced is a completely different experience.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, going into birth, I did not have a birth plan because I know myself well enough to know that if I had a plan, the control freak in me would need to stick to the plan.
Good for you for not having a plan.
And if the plan didn't go accordingly, I would have trouble adjusting. And so I very purposely did not have a birth plan. It was like, women have done this before. Yep. I can do this. That was my birth plan going into my first birth. And I had goals of not having an epidural. And I was in active, like full labor for 12 hours. And then they told me that I'd gained 1 centimeter. And I was like, give me the epidural. Yeah. And then that was, you know, like I hadn't even gone through transition. So I think the worst part of labor, like the hardest part for me the first time around was masked. And then the initial part of labor was so hard and anxiety causing. And when you get induced, your contractions just, they're not the same mm-hmm. as when you're not induced. The Pitocin really changes the birth experience. Mm-hmm. And I know that because the second time I didn't have any, the second time it was really fast. Mm-hmm. My daughter just kind of arrived. They wouldn't actually admit me to the hospital because then they checked me. They said, oh no, you're only at 3 centimeters. And I was like, no, this has got to be a mistake. Like I have to be at more than that. And they had me walk around the hospital for an hour. And then when I got back, she was crowning. They had to rush me up to delivery. So they were two very different experiences. And I think going into my second afterwards, I was more confident as a new mother. Mm-hmm. I kind of felt like I knew what I was doing initially, but that faded quickly because having another young kid just threw me. Mm-hmm. It was a much harder experience when you have a toddler pulling on you. So all the confidence I'd gained initially, I sort of lost very quickly with my second.
Yeah. Did you make work about motherhood after you had your son, or was it kind of more recently after you've had both kids?
It was only recently, which is interesting because I had similar struggles with both kids in terms of breastfeeding. But I think I wasn't in the same place mentally. And with my son, I had just gotten a studio space for the first time since grad school. And I was sort of already knee deep in other projects. And so my head was just not there. Mm-hmm. And with my daughter, I was home making work. Like my studio had been moved home and I had really shifted into full-time mother mode. Mm-hmm. And so the art came from that in a different way, that it just didn't happen like that with my son.
I'm proud to share that this episode of the Artist Mother podcast is sponsored by Faherty. Faherty is a family-run clothing brand fueled by purpose and optimism. They make high-quality, sustainably-minded, feel-good favorites that you'll be proud to wear. This clothing that's made not just to last the season, but a lifetime of wear. For the past few years, I've recently tried to curb my clothes shopping habits and change what I wear to reflect my values. I've pared down my clothes to things I feel good in and feel good about, which means buying less fast fashion and making fewer purchases overall, but buying more high-quality pieces when I do buy my clothes. Faherty brand fits right into this model, and I'm kind of obsessed with their Arlie Day pants. They are super comfortable, but help me look slightly more put together than my usual yoga pants outfits. Anybody feel me? Faherty brand believes in social justice and has partnered with and supported some organizations you may recognize, like United Natives, Artists for Peace and Justice, the Trevor Project, and the Audre Lorde Project. They're also holding their company to a high standard with sustainability, designing clothes to last that are made with low impact on the environment. You can shop Faherty by heading to fahertybrand.com/artistmother. Use code ARTISTMOTHER, all lowercase, all together, for 25% off your purchase. It really means a lot when you support the brands that help support our podcast. Check out Faherty's website today and use code ARTISTMOTHER for a 25% off discount. That's pretty generous, guys. Thank you so much, Faherty, for supporting this podcast and our community. And now back to our episode. So how did you decide to make work about breastfeeding? Like, when you was that the first work that you've made about motherhood, or did you make any work about motherhood prior? Was it kind of like starting with the nipple casting and?
Yeah, no, that was the first work. And it started with an idea about pumps, because I was pumping several times a day to boost my supply. I had low supply, and I know now, you know, that that's most likely a hormone deficiency. Like I was never making enough of the hormone that produces milk, prolactin. And so no matter how much I struggled, I was never really going to be able to boost my supply. But nobody told me that. Like that was research I did down the line to figure that out. And the pump was just this, it felt like a third limb. Like it was just always attached to me, and the sound of it haunted me, and the bottles and the washing and the milk bags and the freezer stash. Like it was all so anxiety producing that at a certain point, and it was around a year ago, actually, like just about a year ago now, that I said, okay, these objects and this process is making me really anxious and it's ruining breastfeeding for me. I want to collect more of these. Like instead of running from that, I said, I want as many of these objects as I can possibly get from other women who are probably feeling similarly. And then I would use the objects to make things. And I did not know what I was going to make. It started with the feeling and the objects. And then I just started collecting them from women from all over. And now I have something like 35 breast pumps in my attic that I'm using for sound pieces, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bottles and nipples, and like my attic is just full of stuff.
That's crazy. Tracy, what about you? You were kind of like nodding vigorously there. I could tell you were connecting with Catherine's story.
Oh yeah. I feel like Catherine and I are living like the same life in a lot of ways. just the collecting breast pumps. And I really admire how you just wanted to understand your struggle. So you just collected all the things that you fear, because I definitely had that desire. So I really relate to that process. Yeah.
I think it's a control thing, because I couldn't control the bodily process and I couldn't control my feelings. But if I got the objects and transformed them, like if I made them into something different, then I could transform how I was feeling.
Yeah. And then you have the power. You're taking power over those.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tracy, how did you decide to make work about breastfeeding? Like what was kind of your in with that?
Well, my breastfeeding, you know, even though my birth was like really fine and joyous, breastfeeding was a disaster. And it was the one thing, like I had no preconceived notion of I'm not going to do an epidural. All of my friends did that and they all had horror stories. So I was kind of like Catherine, I'll go as far as I can, but I'm not going to have any plans, because I know that, you know, the harder you plan, the worse it's going to be. But I was absolutely positive that I was going to breastfeed. Mm. My mom didn't breastfeed me, and I felt like everyone I knew were really, you know, La Leche League.
Yeah.
My mom.
Advocates. Yeah. And so I was like, I'm going to do this, and it's going to be so beautiful, and I'm going to love it. And it was the opposite. I was never able to do it. In the hospital, the lactation consultants said that my nipples were too small, so they gave me nipple shield to start using. And it seemed to me that things weren't working very well. But my son was latching. You know, he was latching, and I was saying to the lactation consultants, this just doesn't feel right. And they're like, no, this is beautiful. This is a beautiful latch. You're great. And as leaving the hospital, there was this like red, I think they call it duck brick dust in my son's diaper as we were leaving, like traces of blood.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I was like, is this normal? And they're like, it's completely normal. It's just a residual bit of your hormones that are in his system. Well, I found out afterwards, it's not at all normal for a boy. Yes. It's completely normal if you had a girl, but not for a little boy. So when we got home, it wasn't until the third day, you know, I'd already been released from the hospital. I'm still breastfeeding, thinking things are going well, because that's what the consultants told me. But by the third or fourth day, he was bright red, screaming the top of his lungs, and his tongue was like sandpaper. Mm. And I was like, okay, there is something seriously wrong. So I called an external lactation consultant, and she came over and was extremely alarmed. She's like, oh my God, he's lost over 10% of his body weight.
Oh my gosh.
And he was really small to begin with. So he had dropped almost a pound. He was 7 pounds when he was born, and he was down to like 6.2. And so immediately, you know, she was like, okay, he's got tongue ties, lip ties, and buckle ties. That's why he's latching, but he can't transfer any milk. So we had two operations. He got the ties lasered twice, but they kept growing back. The scar tissue would just grow back worse than before. And meanwhile, I was like, you know, using a hospital grade pumping machine and pumping every hour around the clock just to get my supply in, because by this time it was like day four and my supply hadn't come in because he wasn't transferring anything.
Right.
So I tried SNS feeding systems. I went to weekly lactation consultant meetings for the first 3 months of his life. I mean, I really, really tried. And after 3 months, you know, it was my lactation consultant was like, I don't understand why you keep coming back here. You've been exclusively breast pumping this whole time. Maybe it's time to just continue on with that, you know? Mm-hmm. And the whole process of pumping was just, you know, pumping and then bottle feeding was so overwhelmingly time consuming that I just pretty much early on, I was like, I need to just make this into my art somehow, you know, to be part of my art. It was sort of like all of this time is taking away, you know, time I would have in my studio. So I'm just going to boil it all, you know, together and make it into an art project. And because I had been working with lactation consultants and all of that, I had been very, very carefully tracking my every time I pumped, how many ounces I collected. I'd been tracking on a cell phone app. And it occurred to me, I was like, wait, I have all of this data. You know, I kept doing it diligently for a year. And so once I had accumulated, you know, 4 or 5 months, I was like, I'm going to just keep going for as long as I can. And then I'm going to figure out something that I can do with this data.
Mm. And that's the piece you made, which was in Painting at Night.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about that piece. You know, we'll have it so people can see it when they listen to the interview, but could you talk specifically about that piece?
Yeah. So that was the second piece in my, you know, pumping series. Both projects were direct translations of the data from my cell phone app. And I was really just trying to, you know, I was thinking about what is it that I want people to take away from this art project, you know, or the experience of pumping. And I think what captured my interest most was just the sheer, you know, just the overwhelming amount of time that was spent, and also just the insane quantity of milk, which I don't remember off the top of my head, but it was well over 1,000 gallons of milk that I had collected over a year. And it was just like, I was just so impressed that the human body can do that. And also just like so impressed that women dedicate so much time and energy to the act of feeding their children, and nobody cares. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so underrecognized. And so I felt like that's really what I wanted to highlight. So I created, at first it was a series of 12 paintings. Each painting represented 1 month of data. But the piece that's in Painting at Night is all 12 months combined into one quilt.
Mm-hmm. While I Was Away, I think it's called.
Yeah, right? The piece is called While I Was Away. It's a circular quilt, and it's basically, the background is all of these colors. The colors directly correspond with the color of the sky from outside my window. So it maps the sunrise and sunset, and it was all done very precisely using, like, you know, the weather data in Chicago. You know, my studio assistant and I sort of figured out this whole map of colors to describe the type of weather and the time of day. So it starts off really dark in the center, and then you can see the sunrise, and then as you move out to the edge of the quilt, it goes to the sunset again. And then every pumping session that I had was indicated on the quilt as a bead, like a string of beads that would come off of the quilt, and they just droop down. Mm-hmm. So they are placed on the quilt at the precise time that I had done that pumping session. Mm. And then the length is the exact quantity of ounces. So it's an ounces to inches translation. And it just hangs on the wall. It's like awkward, you know, because it's kind of random the way that the beads cascade, but you can see the 360 degree circle. You can see where the beads, the strands start off teeny tiny. That's where my milk was coming in. And then you can see that it becomes like very repetitive, where I was like in a pattern. I was pumping every 3 hours. And then you can see where I was starting to taper off. And then at the end, you know, days, you know, maybe 3 days where I wouldn't pump at all because I was starting to wean. Mm-hmm. So in that way, it's really interesting because you can actually truly see the cycle, you know, that.
Yeah, it's one of those pieces that it's like, it's just physically beautiful, but then when you understand what it is, you're like, you know, just your like mind is blown. You're like, I'm going to weep in front of this piece. It's so good. I just wanted to say that I remember installing that piece, and I think you had warned us over email, like, you know, just so you know, like it is kind of heavy, and like, I didn't remember like you talking about the weight of it. And, you know, like when Robin and I, like we unrolled it, and I was just like, you know, like I remember like lifting it up and being like, wait, what is this piece about? And then being like, and like, just, you know, just because I felt like even just the weight of the material of the piece was like translating all of that unseen labor. Like it was so powerful. So it's just,
well, and I think that that's another example of what Catherine was talking about earlier, that the material is the message. You know, like even though the paintings I still really love because they were a labor of love, the decision to make the, to translate the data into a quilt, you know, which is such a part of mother and child mm-hmm. and passed down through the generations and is supposed to provide comfort. And, you know, to me, the point of that quilt was, first of all, to make it really clear to any outsider just how much labor is involved mm-hmm. in this process, but also that all of the times that I was attached to that pump were times that I was not able to hold my son. Mm-hmm. You know, when he was crying, I could give him a bottle next to me, but I could not put him in my arms. And so a lot of the quilt was about just really trying to uncover, why is it that it's so important that we breastfeed? Mm-hmm. You know, like, yes, I transferred all of my, you know, great hormones and immune system to my son, but I was not able to provide the comfort that he really needed, you know? Mm-hmm. And so is that really a better choice? You know,
like maybe not just holding him, but giving him a bottle could have provided.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not that I'm trying to beat myself up. I know that I did what made the most sense for me, but it's more about trying to help other women to understand that breast is not always best.
Yeah.
That I don't think that a lot of women, most women don't realize that there are, it, for some of us, it is impossible to breastfeed. Mm-hmm. And taking on the added shame of, you know, having to bottle feed, like, I just don't think we don't need any room for that. There's no room for any more shame. Mm-hmm.
No more shame. No more shame.
Yeah.
Catherine, you look like you want to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, so much of what Tracy's saying I can relate to. And like, even though I can't, I am still breastfeeding my daughter. She's coming up on 21 months. And I'm able to. There's so much that doesn't get talked about, though. The debate is always framed as, are you choosing to breastfeed or are you choosing formula? And there's so little attention paid to, it's not always a choice. Mm-hmm. For most women, it's not a choice. For people who have to go back to work, for like, there's so little about motherhood that we actually get to choose. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so limiting to only have the conversation dedicated to whether or not you are breastfeeding. And then the debate about, you know, which is best and neither is best. And there's so many other things. There's so many other emotions that go into it and feelings of inadequacy, even if you are breastfeeding, and the mm-hmm. pain. Like, I've been collecting statements from mothers. I'm calling them milk testimonials, and I'm asking mm-hmm. moms to send me, you know, like 200 words or 1 to 2 minutes if it's an audio clip, telling me something, anything about their experience breastfeeding. And as I read these and collect them, the thing that really, it just makes me cry over and over and over again, is this feeling of inadequacy. Mm-hmm. This, like, I'm not a good enough mother, either because I don't have enough milk, or because I have to pump exclusively, or because I had to use formula, or because I didn't like breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of women who, you know, are admitting to me, I did breastfeed, I hated it. And the whole time I hated it, I felt bad about that. So it's like, there's no way to feel like you're doing it right all the time and that you've made the right choice. And then society just piles it on. Like, I just, you know, Tracy, you brought up La Leche League earlier. And my mom gave me a copy of The Womanly Art of Breastfeeding when I got pregnant with my son. And I read a bunch of it at the time. And I highlighted some. And it wasn't until after I had my daughter and I was sort of struggling with all these feelings that I looked back into that book. And there was this one passage that talked about how breastfeeding was the most important thing you could do for your child in their life, like the most important. And I was just full of rage. Like, I read it and I was just enraged that printed. And then I was like, wait a minute, how many times has this been reprinted? and just seeing that every edition that had been left in there. Mm-hmm. And it made me so mad. And so I'm actually working on a text piece where I'm dissecting that book and cutting out.
I was going to say that book needs to be worked into your heart. Well, too, I think, Catherine, even this conversation about choice, where we're so overwhelmed by choices and it gives us anxiety, choice equals privilege.
Yeah.
You know, and so many people don't even get to choose. And if they could choose, you know, they might want something else, but their circumstances don't allow them the flexibility or the finances or the support to I just feel like that's important to say too, that
absolutely
all of these conversations that even we're having, there's people who couldn't even they're that's great. But I couldn't even consider that because of my life circumstances. And, I feel that's a whole other unseen labor conversation about motherhood, is privilege.
Having to go back to work, if you don't have a job that, if you're on an hourly shift, you can't be pumping every couple hours. I mean, legally, I guess they have to let you. But we all know that that doesn't really matter in practice and that women are not going to fight for those rights if they feel like it will then make them, on a hit list of who's going to get fired next. Mm-hmm. It's just there's nothing equitable about breastfeeding in our society, who gets to pump, who doesn't get a pump, who gets taught how to do this, the education involved in breastfeeding.
The cost of hiring lactation consultants. I mean, my privilege was so laid bare by being able to hire lactation consultants. I happened to be on a year-long sabbatical from teaching, so I was able to just sit in my chair all day and be a milking cow, but most women don't have that
that access.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think even just hearing the tenderness and the authenticity of your struggles, there's some people who would feel fortunate to be able to have the time and space to do that, exactly what you just said, Tracy. So I just think that's important for us to think about too. And are there art or is there art being made out there that is sort of about that unseen privilege of motherhood? That's something I want to investigate a little bit more. I'm sure there's art in our new virtual exhibition that's about that if I dig a little bit deeper, but sometimes you just have to sit with a piece and really soak it in or know more about the artist until you kind of really realize everything that the work is saying. Catherine, could you talk a little bit about the specific piece that you had in Painting at Night too? Just want to make sure we talk about that piece because we spent time talking about Tracy's and it's such an important work that Allison Remus curated into the show or juried into the show, not curated. Could you talk about 13 Nipples?
Sure. So when I first started collecting all these objects, I did not know what I was going to do with them. It was I knew I needed the objects and I figured I would be able to figure out some way to use them. And the first material that I sort of gravitated to were the silicone nipples. For several reasons. I think that the nipple conversation for me mattered because Tracy, I was also told my nipples were too flat I had to use nipple shield initially. There was lots of talk about if I was supplementing, if I did that with a bottle, would there be nipple confusion? And would I ruin my breastfeeding relationship by using the silicone nipple? And have you tried this brand? And if your baby won't take a bottle, try this one. There's so much wrapped up in those stupid nipples. And so that was the first material that I picked up and really said, okay, I can use this. And I'm not coming from a sculpture background. And so even gravitating towards these 3D materials and saying, I'm going to make work with this was so new to me. But I decided to work in cement. And I chose cement because it's this pedestrian heavy building material. It's not considered a fine art material. It's it's used to strengthen and to support things. And I thought, well, that's what mothers do. Mm-hmm. And it's heavy. And it spoke to the weight of the burden that I had been feeling. And I also like the idea that when the piece is done, it doesn't look like it's heavy. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's fragile and it looks like it's small. And, but then you pick it up and you're sort of like, oh, this has weight to it. Mm-hmm. And that spoke to me about how much we kind of hide the weight that we're feeling as mothers, that mm-hmm. on the outside, everything looks fine. And then on the inside, we're feeling all these heavy feelings. So that piece, that was a real trial and error. Like I said, because I'd never really done this. And the way that I make them is I make each nipple individually, and then I build the towers, adhering them with cement as I go, sort of. And I had so many break. Like I had so many pieces break in that process. So that tower was sort of the first real good one. And I submitted it. I was nervous about that submission. I think I messaged you like a bunch of times being like, can I submit multiple views of my sculpture? Cause I was just so,
yes, you did. I forgot that. Yeah. I was like, what? I don't understand.
I like didn't know how to submit sculptures. Like it was this really new experience for me.
That's so funny.
Yeah, it was just a new territory.
I love, though, that it was your first, you know, your first nipple sculpture is like the one that got accepted into the show. I just think that's really cool.
It was so validating.
Yeah.
Because here's me doing this like giant leap away from what I was used to doing, mm-hmm. and new materials, new themes, everything about it was new. And so to have that be accepted, it really launched this body of work off on the right foot, so to speak. Like I really felt just like, okay, yeah, this is a direction I can continue to pursue. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the artist mother community has just been so supportive and embraced that work so much. So I'm so thankful for that.
So beautiful.
Yeah. And I know, you know, we've talked about how grateful we are for the great review in the Brooklyn Rail that the show had, thanks to Robert Shane and the good work that he's doing, you know, from an art history perspective, like a mm-hmm. writer trying to make all these connections with art, the historical lens through art and motherhood, and tying it in with all the contemporary stuff that's happening. So that was super great and validating.
Yeah, that was a great review.
It was. Okay, so both of you have kind of, well, I guess I don't know if you're done having kids, but you've been through this, like, you know, crazy, you've had a baby and you've been through breastfeeding journeys, and you're kind of like a little bit on the other side of it. Catherine, I know your daughter's still just about 2 or, you know, close to that age. But just curious, like, what do you think is next for you in your art? Do you feel like, you know, like, I think a lot of people make art in the early stages of motherhood about sort of the maternal journey because it's just so visceral intense. And in your space. And yeah, like, it's so intense. You know, and I've talked about this before, but like I had this experience when I was in my MFA program because I was, you know, kind of trying to wrap my head around making work about motherhood. And I remember one of my professors saying like, well, what are you going to make work about? Like when you're not, you know, in this early stage of motherhood where it's so, you know, what, like she kind of said it like when you're not a mom. And I'm like, well, first of all, I'll always be a mom. Like, you know, but like I knew what she meant, but also I don't know. It was kind of insulting because it was like, you know, you have to make work about the real you, not just like something you're experiencing in the moment. And right. I'm like, isn't that what like artists do? Is like they engage with like what's happening in the moment, and or like that's one way an artist works. You know, there's no. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just curious, like if you thought about sort of future projects or where you see, you know, your work going. Maybe you're working on something right now that's like diverting from motherhood, or maybe not. Tracy, do you have a project in mind that you're working on right now?
Yeah, I'm kind of working on 2 projects simultaneously. I am, believe it or not, teaching myself to sew because I do not know how to make quilts. That was the quilt was digitally, you know, it was a design that I designed on the computer and printed onto the fabric, and then hired a professional long arm quilter to do the quilting. And then especially getting to know all of these amazing, you know, fiber-based artists that are part of the Artist Mother community, I really was like, I feel so embarrassed to have this quilt that's, you know, getting some intention, and I don't even know how to sew. So
see, I was like, hey, she's big enough to hire somebody. That's great. Good for her.
Yeah, so I got a sewing machine and I'm teaching myself to sew. And so I want to make a couple more quilts. I'm interested in revisiting this subject, but with other women's data and using an image of their actual breast as the background for the quilt. And at the same time, I'm sort of thinking through, I really want to revisit my infertility and my medical records that are, you know, focused on that period in my life and do something new, you know, data visualization with those medical records. It's something that I have been thinking about for, you know, years, and it's like such a big part of my life that I want to do it justice. So I just am like, you know, I've been doing a lot of drawing and sketching and trying to figure out what the best way is to approach that body of upcoming work.
Excited to see more of that.
Yeah.
Catherine, what about you? What are some newer projects that you're working on?
I'm going to be here for a long time, I think. You know, I have 4 to 6 hours a week of making time if I'm lucky. Yeah. And I have notebooks full of pieces that have yet to be executed and done to my satisfaction. Like this whole past year, I think I was more executing prototypes and then like just trying everything out. And now I'm at the point where it's like, okay, I've experimented for a year. Now I know what I want to make. And so I look at the work that I made in the last year as all sort of like potential directions to go in. And I'm going in several of those directions at once. So it's like, okay, I'm making cement standing sculptures and table sculptures and wall sculptures. And then I'm going to start doing hanging sculptures and more like object sculptures. And then I'm also painting with breast milk. So I've collected a lot of frozen expired milk and I paint with it. And those pieces are just sort of at their beginning stages. I'm more starting to investigate like mother as consumed animal and as a food product and kind of like what's left after a mother has been wholly consumed and we've sort of given ourselves over to this role completely, what kind of person we are afterwards. And I feel like I was worried when I started this that sort of getting pigeonholed is like, okay, you're an artist who only makes work about motherhood and therefore your work can only be shown in shows about motherhood. And that really was, I was nervous about that initially. And every once in a while, I'm still nervous. But I think I'm seeing that, like you said, artists make work about whatever's going on in their life all the time. And for some reason, work about motherhood has always been kind of put to the side or, I don't know, dismissed. And as if like, oh, well, that's just your personal issue. That has nothing to do with like the wider community and art. And I'm finding that that's just not true. And so in order for me to like push against that boundary, I kind of really want to keep making this work and to very specifically amplify it and be like, you know, I'm not in this stage anymore. Maybe when I'm done breastfeeding, but that doesn't mean other women aren't.
Yeah.
And like, I feel like a lot of this work is for other mothers. So I think I'm going to be here for a while.
Yeah.
I love that. Tracy, have you ever felt that like, just, I don't know, is this work going to be accepted by other shows or is it only going to be in shows about specifically about the maternal experience?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a conversation that I know is very prevalent, but I feel like my personal journey as an artist, you know, I just was at the lowest of the lows when I started making art again. So at that point, I didn't really have any strong intentions of showing any work. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, I don't care if anybody ever sees my work again. I'm just happy to be making art again. Mm-hmm. And I think I've come out of that. And now I'm like, no, I actually do want people to see my work.
Yeah.
But I hadn't really found a community of like-minded artists until I started making art about motherhood. Mm. So even though I feel like, yeah, that it, you know, my subject matter might keep me out of exhibitions, I feel more a part of an artist community than I ever have been. And so I'm just grateful for that, you know? Mm. I guess I don't really care whether people think my work is, you know, uninteresting because it's about the maternal experience. That's fine. I'm happy to have this like tight group of, you know, supporters who really do care. And I'm also really happy to make art that might give meaning or inspiration to another young, you know, another mother who's struggling, you know, and that's more what I'm interested in.
Like making my heart go pitter patter. Like just because I can like see how even just the artist mother community is like validating artists like you and your work, who I'm like, I think your work is amazing and I respect you so much. And like to know that something like this podcast and like the work that we're doing, you know, it's kind of like just seeing it kind of bounce back and forth is like so wonderful and like just like filling me up. I too like find myself kind of between that, like I think we need shows just about motherhood, like Painting at Night, because it mm-hmm. shows the range of you know, like that show, and that is going to be like our annual show. Like we're always gonna have, you know, this open call once a year for Painting at Night. But like that show is always going to it's not a funnel. Like it's going to show, it's going to open up the conversation because it is a conversation that is pushed off to the side. It's still not, you know, completely validated and accepted in the art world. So to have a show about it is like just needed still in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, and even though I think it's absolutely needed without question, it's also really exciting that the three of us happen to be lucky enough to be artists and newish mothers at this time, because I feel like there's just this huge opening up of this conversation. There's so many artists that are making work about this. There's so many exhibitions that are being curated on this topic. The fact that your podcast just went bonkers in like 1 year, you know, just as a testament to how much this conversation was needed.
Yeah. And too, I think like the more that we're pushing and having shows and showing and curating, the more like getting your work, Catherine, in, you know, the Manifest Gallery as like one piece of, like, wasn't it a show about hoarding or something, but you have like a collection of nipples. And it's like one piece within the show is about motherhood. Like, I think we have to keep pushing so that so it normalizes like the work, like it's going to overflow and overspill. And like, it has to be picked up by the broader art world because we're here. Yeah.
I want it to be about the work. Like, I guess what bugs me so much, work about motherhood gets cast as, well, it's really about motherhood. The work is secondary.
As
it's
if,
the motherhood
like, thing. Right.
And it's like, no, the work is the work.
Right.
Like, if the work is good, the work should show, regardless of, you know, I feel like themes get accepted a lot wider when they're men's themes.
Yes.
So it's just, it really makes me mad.
Yep. Yeah. Definitely. Okay. Just one or two more questions. I feel like we could talk all night about this, but then we'll wrap up. So, Catherine, you were kind of talking about like how you have just notebooks full of ideas and, you know, just this like backlog of work that you want to make and like not enough time to make it. I also feel the same way. But I was wondering if either of you have sort of like a process or a way to like organize ideas for when you can't make work because of like your job or motherhood. This is more like a practical question just for people who like feel like they're in the same boat. Like, how do you like kind of keep those ideas like ticking in your mind and like save them for later in a way that like feels like you're still engaging with your practice even when you can't like be in the studio. You want to start, Catherine?
Sure. The notebook is important. So I have an actual physical notebook that I write in. And that involves both writing and little diagrams. Like I make little diagrams of sculptures that I want to make and ideas. And then I have a note on my phone so that whenever I have an idea, if I don't have my notebook, I can put it in there. And it's just this one really long like note that I need to scroll through.
You need to organize that thing.
I know. I'm sure there's a better way to do this. So maybe I'm not like the best person to follow on this. But I will say I only get 4 to 6 hours a week dedicated to art. And that's not just making. That's like website updating, writing proposals, like anything that has to do with being an artist. That's how much time I get. But I try to do at least one thing every day. Because if I do one thing every day, then I feel like I have momentum. And if that one thing is just like one entry in that notebook, that's my one thing. If my one thing is reading a chapter in The Womanly Art of Breastfeeding, that's my one thing. I hope that that's not my one thing most days, but yeah. I try to just keep my head in it somehow, because if I go 2 weeks without thinking about this stuff, then when I go back into it, I feel like I'm starting from scratch in a lot of ways. And so it's really just like dipping the toe in the water constantly, like just keep checking the water. Is this the temperature? Is this where I want to be? Just constantly keep checking in with myself. Because otherwise I lose momentum and then it's really hard to get it back again. So that's what I do.
I like that. Tracy, what about you?
I feel like I should be taking notes because I don't really have a good system. I do also keep a notebook, but I'm not very diligent about keeping track of notes. It's all just sort of stuck in my head. I try as often as I can to, like Catherine said, try to do one thing every day. But I often don't get that luxury in the midst of the semester. So yeah, I don't have any good systems. I'm a very disorganized person. So I'm just going to take notes and write down all of the suggestions that you guys have.
I will say, Caitlin, and this will sort of counter some of the ideas and the sort of painting at night was pushing back against. So I work at home now. And I will say that I actually find it is better for me to keep that momentum going because I walk by the work. It's like all of my nipple towers are on a shelf in my kids' toy room. Not the best decision of where to put it. And we've had accidents, but it's the only shelf I have available. And so every time I'm in there, I see them. It's like, because I work all over my house, I don't even have like one dedicated studio space. It's like I do the breast milk painting on my kitchen floor. I do the cement casting on the kitchen table or on our back deck. Like there's bits of my work all over our house at all times. And so it's never like gone from my mind. I can always see little bits of it. And that helps me actually like keep tabs on it. Like it's never really gone. And so that's one benefit of working at home. And sometimes there aren't that many benefits. And so I think it's really important to find them when you can.
Yeah, I love that idea about momentum too. I can't remember. I actually had written that word down somewhere. And I want to use it to talk about, because I heard it in an interview, I read it somewhere, but somebody was just saying basically that when you don't have a lot of time, just exactly what you said, Catherine, like just use the little bit of time you have to keep dipping, keep the momentum going. You know, I think some of us, like even I've been guilty of like, I'm just going to get like my one studio day a week and that'll be enough. And like, we go through phases, right? Like sometimes we need different things and we change, but, and like the other days, I'm just going to like not worry about it. And, you know, like trust that like that one day will come and I'll get it in there. But I do think that like, I like thinking about my work all the time, and I like keeping that momentum going. And I do think there's something to be said for that kind of productivity, you know, like, yes, it's all we have sometimes, and it sucks, and we're divided and we're distracted, but that doesn't mean that we can't make good art, right? And it doesn't mean that we're not trying, and it doesn't mean that, like, we're not building on this momentum. Like, even this idea of the 100 gallons of breast milk, Tracy, that were just like...
No, it's over 1,000 gallons.
1,000 gallons, like just little ounces at a time, you know? Like, and it's when you've got a screaming baby and you've got, you know, like, I love how that those two ideas kind of overlap in that, you know, this is all we have to work with. Like, we're trying to do these impossible things, and it's the best we have. Like, I wrote in my studio notebook the other day, hurrying is all I have. Like, I feel like I'm in a hurry in the studio. I'm in a hurry all the time to, like, do all the things that I want to do. And, like, I know stillness and slowness and rest is important, but I'm also just, like, I literally, this is all I have because I want to do all of these things. And, you know, that's okay. Yeah. Like, I think I just have to accept that, like, that is all I have right now. And that's okay too, you know?
Yeah.
Efficiency is, like, the biggest part of my life right now.
Yes. Wait, did you say efficiency or deficiency?
Yeah, like being as efficient as possible efficiency. Whenever I can is, like, just get it done. Just be efficient.
Yeah.
So hard.
To a lot of the other podcasts I listen to is Women at Work. Mm-hmm. And they talk a lot about, you know, this idea of why women don't get hired, you know, because the fear that hiring a woman is, you know, they're just going to quit their job and have babies. And, you know, becoming a mother has made me realize that hiring mothers is the best decision that a manager could make, because women know how to get shit done.
Amen.
Kid, you know how to make 10 minutes feel like 10 hours.
Yeah. Yes. I think that's our new artist mother t-shirt. I've been thinking of, like, we need a logo. We know how to get shit done. That's what it's going to be. I love that. This has been such a great conversation. I'm just so thankful for both of you being willing to share about your journeys. I always close our interviews with 5 questions just for us to get to know you a little better. So I'll ask the question and have both of you answer, and we'll go through the 5. So Tracy, who's your biggest art crush?
I have to say Michelle Grabner, who was my advisor in grad school. I've always been a really big fan of her work, and she was an incredibly generous advisor in grad school and just a generous human being in general. But I don't think I really fully appreciated her until after I had a baby. Mm. I was always amazed that she was running a gallery and writing, you know, art criticism and curating shows, and, you know, her prolific studio career and being a professor and, you know, 3 kids, just so much going on. And then when I became an artist, it was like, not an artist, a mother, I realized she is like a superhero. Mm-hmm. So I think she's my art crush.
I got to get her on the podcast.
Yeah.
It's going to happen 2021. Catherine, what about you? Who's your biggest art crush?
Impossible question for me. Like, I was thinking, because it changes on like a day-to-day basis, like who I'm looking at and who I'm really interested in. I love Bev Fishman's work. Just the colors are amazing. And I don't know, she's like, I look at her work and I look at Joseph Albers and just, I really like her work. Ernesto Burgos sculptures really speak to me. And I think since I've started working in 3D, kind of finding sculpture artists is more new for me. I really like his pieces. And then Esther Ruiz, I really like, I have a sculpture of hers that I cherish. Those are 3.
Okay. You know, COVID times, but we all are dreaming of travel right now. So Tracy, what's your favorite place to travel or a dream trip that you'd like to go on?
I think I am dreaming right now of renting a van or a little caravan and just national parking for the whole summer 2021.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, living in a campfire, you know, by a campfire, just traveling with no worries.
Yes.
I'm dying to do that.
Yes.
Visiting all the family that I haven't seen in a year.
Love that.
And being in nature. Yeah.
Catherine, what about you? Favorite place to travel or a dream trip?
I've traveled a lot in Asia, and I would love to go back there because I haven't been back in, I don't know, over 10 years, 15 years almost. We actually had a trip canceled in June because of COVID. We were supposed to go to France for 2 weeks or 3 weeks and Scotland for 2 weeks. Mm. My husband had a conference in France, and then a friend was getting married in Scotland, and we somehow figured out this awesome trip, and then it got canceled.
That sucks.
So that would, I would like to go on that trip.
Yeah, you're like the one I was supposed to go on.
I would like that month in Europe, which is like this amazing thing that would never probably happen again. The timing was perfect. So yeah, that would have been fun.
You'll get there. You'll get to do it.
One day.
Okay, back to you, Tracy. What film or book has inspired you greatly?
I'm going to say two books because it's hard to narrow it down to just one. Salman Rushdie's novel Shame, which is all about this woman who has this terrible affliction that she soaks in all the unfelt shame from everyone around her. And that really inspired a lot of work for me just about feminine shame. And then also Larry McMurtry's Oh, What a Slaughter. Which is all about massacres in American history where Native Americans were either the victims or wrongly accused of the crimes. Those two books have probably inspired 15 years worth of work.
Love knowing that. I've never heard of that Shame book. I'm going to look that up.
Oh, so good.
Catherine, what about you? Favorite, or not favorite, but just a film or book that has inspired you greatly?
I really couldn't pick one that had inspiration on my work, which was really interesting to me. Like I thought about a lot of books and films that I love and that I adore, but they didn't really, like very little of it comes into my work. But what I did come up with was I'm a fantasy reader, and I think the idea of world building and creating something that is familiar but also unfamiliar, like that whole, that's sort of like the basis for fantasy. Take a little bit of like an entry point that people can get through. And then once they're through that door, make something that they don't know. And I think that's what I try to do in all of my work. Like offer enough of an access point and then kind of introduce something unfamiliar or strange. So fantasy in general has had a big effect on me.
Nice. Okay, Tracy, what's your favorite meal?
Anything that has New Mexico Hatch green chili on it. I don't care what it is. I'll eat a green chili popsicle.
There's probably some out there, I bet.
Yeah, and I'm kidding. I probably wouldn't eat that.
Oh, you know, it's probably mixed with coconut milk. It's creamy and spicy. I can see it already. It's there. Catherine, what about you? What's your favorite meal?
Penne alla vodka and garlic bread.
Yeah, we talked about that. That's like one of my favorites too. The best penne alla vodka is this place in Little Italy called La Mela. Have you ever heard of La Mela?
No. I'll challenge you though.
So
I will
good.
Counter you with a Graziella's in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. That
well,
is
I've never been there, so it's probably, you're probably right because Little Italy versus Brooklyn, I'm sure, but, you know, I've spent far too little time in Brooklyn for my life. I just die to get back there, but, you know, sometimes life doesn't provide us with those opportunities. Sometimes the European trips get canceled, and
I know.
All right, last but not least, in the spirit of community, because we can't do this alone, I always like to offer just a space for you to give a shout out to thank someone for supporting, who supports you and your work, Tracy.
I want to give a shout out to the two women that I met when I was a brand new mom at a artist or at a new mom's group at the hospital. Angela Lopez and Emily Linskoog, who are also contemporary artists. The three of us had children the same age, and they, like, I really feel like they dragged me out of my depression and really helped me get back on my feet as an artist. And of course, my husband, he is an amazing father and so generous in giving me lots of studio time. So I could not be an artist without the three of those people.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, what about you?
Husband gets the biggest shout out. I think he supports my career just emotionally, financially, just all the support in the world that I could ask for. He's there for me. And my best friend, Caitlin Flynn, who is also an artist mother. She lives in Florida and I don't get to see her much, but we met in grad school and she's been my rock for years and years. And then two others, Allison Chen, who I met through she was also in the Painting at Night show. And I've been in two crit groups with her now, and also Stay Home Gallery. And so she and I in the past year, yeah, I felt like we like had this whole year together.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize you were in two crit groups together. That's cool.
Yeah. When I signed up for the second one with Sarah, Allison was like, oh, I can't miss that. And so, yeah.
I mean, I knew on paper, but like I didn't.
Right.
Haven't thought about it, but yeah.
Yeah, no, that's been a really good relationship. And I would actually say, without naming people, the so much support from people I do not even know. So many messages on Instagram and other artists supporting me on Instagram, you know, just the shout outs and the shares and the comments. People kind of look down on social media a lot at times, but I know that this project and my work would not be where it is today without that support. Mm-hmm. So I'm super thankful of the online community that sort of held me.
Hmm. All right. And speaking of that, where can people find you? What is your website and Instagram handle? Catherine, you can start.
Okay. My website is CatherineDuclo.com. And my Instagram handle is Catherine_Duclo_Rose. And you can also email me if you're interested in participating in my project, donating supplies, or telling me about your experience. You can email me at lowsupplyproject@gmail.com.
Tracy, what about you? Where can people find more about you and your work?
You can find me on Instagram at Tracy, TracyM Taylor, or on my website at TracyMarieTaylor.com.
Cool. Thank you both so much. This is, like I said before, just been nourishing for me and, you know, feels like it's filling my cup to just have like our energies and our, you know, like what we're trying to do in the world be like connecting at this time, kind of like you said, Tracy. It just feels really special. So thank you for sharing your journeys and your art.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes.
Such an honor.
Same.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.